This podcast was produced and recorded in late 2021. Since then, issues in our region and across the country have only gotten worse. The annual CEX Sleepout is back in June, and it's a great time to remind people of this alarming trend. Hi, my name's Ben Stevenson. Welcome to the COFS Housing Crisis Podcast. The aim of this podcast is to highlight the growing issue of housing and homelessness on the COFS Coast. The lack of housing is a major concern for renters, with vacancies plummeting and rental prices skyrocketing. This has added immense stress to COFS households and is leaving more people than ever facing the threat of homelessness. It's a complex issue with a lot to unpack. Although the last 2 years have been the worst, the underlying issues have existed for quite some time. In other words, the fire was already lit. COVID was just your idiot mate who poured petrol on the fire for fun. Emma from the Housing Matters Action Group has been working on this issue for the past 4 years.
So I am currently the vice chairperson of Housing Matters Action Group and have been involved since we first formed about 4 years ago. So we are a volunteer, well, mostly volunteer organisation of community members who have got an interest or expertise in the housing field. We come together to try and find local solutions. You know, we can see that there's a housing crisis in the community. We know that we can't wait for government to come along and fix it. So we thought, well, let's see, you know, what could be possible in this area. 4 years ago, we were talking about housing stress, and we were talking about how we could see the trajectory of where things were going, and that we could see that it was definitely a low income issue. It was creeping into moderate incomes. There were particular groups such as older women that were facing more precarious housing. And then when COVID hit, basically it was like watching a car crash in slow motion, and we just kind of were saying, this is going to, you know, exacerbate things. And definitely by sort of October, November last year, when we were looking at the stats and talking with people, we had very clearly tipped over into housing crisis. That's the terminology that we use now, and that's our reality.
Before the pandemic, there was already overwhelming evidence the housing system was under stress. The 2 years following the pandemic have only worsened it. One factor in this has been a rise in internal migration. With many offices offering a work from home option, heaps of Sydney-siders took that opportunity to swap their surroundings for something a lot nicer.
The internal migration is a really big issue. You know, we have got a whole lot of people leaving metro areas to come to regional areas, and that can be a blessing and a curse. And I think you mentioned there about being able to work remotely, and that's where we're seeing some of this extra stratification, where people who are on city-based wages, who can work remotely or, you know, in those kind of higher paid roles, can afford housing in this area, but that causes that disconnect with the local wages. I guess there's a few different things that have happened. I saw a stat a while ago where it was basically saying that the bottom 10% of the market, you know, had 110% growth rate. So that, you know, people who have the means looking for the opportunities to buy either into the market or to build investment portfolios, whether that's for rentals or Airbnbs, you know, that piece of the market has disappeared. And we've seen it, you know, in the jumping of the median house prices and rents and unit prices. It's all kind of going through the roof. You know, a few months ago, I looked at what the median rent was in Coffs Harbour, and over the 12-month average from April 2020 to March 21, median rents were sitting at around $425 per week. Today, when I checked it, that's jumped up to $550 a week. You know, and there's in Coffs Harbour, we're seeing a fairly consistent increase around 17.5% each year. In Bellingen, when I looked, we're sitting at $540 a week, and that's been an increase of 28.5% over the year. So, you know, I can't think of any incomes on local wages that have jumped anything like that. I know houses around here that were $400 a week and that are now $600 a week. And, you know, I just don't know how families and individuals can cope with that. And, you know, when I look at the vacancy rate, so the Real Estate Institute recognises that a healthy rental vacancy rate is around 3%. You know, we are consistently in the Mid-North Coast area below 1% nowadays. You know, so Coffs Harbour is sitting at about 0.8% when I checked today. Bellingen's on 0.2%, you know, and we've had times where we've hit zero, which means that there just isn't a rental property available. Then when you think about that, you know, that's devastating. We know that we've got so many families getting pushed out of the area, but we also know that it's having flow-on impacts in the workforce. So I know that there is a teacher camping in a showground nearby because they can't find suitable accommodation. And I was, you know, talking with someone in health who was saying they're offering positions to people to work in our hospitals, but then they're having to decline those positions because they can't find housing. You know, and these are the traditionally well-paid, fairly stable, ongoing jobs. If they can't find housing, you know, where do the retail staff and the baristas and the apprentices and all of those people, you know, where are they? What hope have they got of finding somewhere?
All right, Ben, we get it. We're in a tough spot at the moment. But isn't everybody in Australia doing it tough right now? What with COVID and the economy the way it is? Fair question. And we are. However, Coffs Harbour still remains a standout among New South Wales towns. Cathy from Shelter New South Wales explains more.
So Shelter New South Wales is what's called the peak body for housing policy in New South Wales. So we've been around for about 40 years and we advocate to government on behalf of the lowest 40% of income earners in the state who are largely renters, but not always, to make sure they get a better deal for safe, secure and affordable housing. We're independent. We do get funding from government because they recognise that they need an independent body who will tell them how it is and talk to them straight. So, but we're not on the government payroll at all.
First of all, isn't that the dream, getting paid by the government to tell the government they're not doing a good enough job? Cathy explains that when it comes to housing, Coffs has a pretty lousy report card.
We commissioned a group called Regional Australia Institute. We said to them, look, we want to get more involved with regional New South Wales, but we want to make sure we focus on the right parts of New South Wales. You know, we want to, you know, focus our advocacy work in towns and council areas that really need it. So we asked them to go and do a report and tell us what are the top 10 parts of New South Wales in terms of local government areas that are really kind of hotspots in terms of housing issues, and Coffs was one of them. There are a lot of people, there's a lot of renters in the area. There's a lot of single parent families. What that tells us is that typically single parent families struggle with rental and housing costs. There's a lot of people, a lot of low income people, whether they're paying mortgages or rent, paying a lot of money, you know, for that. And so that they are experiencing what's called housing stress. If you're paying more than 30% of your income for housing, so whether it's rent or your mortgage, you are in what's called housing stress.
So where does Coffs rank? You know, we love a list.
So our list is higher need housing areas. So in terms of the most chronic, going through the 10, Central Coast in New South Wales, then Byron, then Cessnock, then Newcastle, then Coffs. So it's in the top five of housing issues.
What this means is the Coffs Coast has a higher than average number of people on the social housing waiting list.
In the Coffs area, there, as of last year, the government figures were that there are 841 applications for, these are approved applications for social housing in the Coffs local government area. And each application could represent a couple or a family, right? So that's quite a lot of people. And they're waiting 10 plus years, which is a long time. So they're treading water financially, just keeping their heads above the waterline, waiting. And if they're a family, they could go there, you know, the kids would be growing up, and they're growing up in poverty, basically, because while they might have a roof over their head, they'll be struggling big time.
One thing we do know is that living in this kind of environment can have an incredible impact on somebody's mental and physical health, and an even greater effect on young people and their development.
I mean, first of all, the quality of when people are living in poorly designed housing, like it can be an unhealthy life. If you're a poor renter, I'll use that term. If you're a poor renter, you're often in pretty crappy places. If you're often being parts of town that are really isolated. So your option to get employment, if you're a kid teenager and you're wanting to get part-time jobs, you know, you're often in housing that's really poorly located in terms of public transport. So it does start to really stunt development. But it doesn't have to be that way. There are plenty of fantastic social housing communities that are very strong communities. People look out for each other. You don't have to have a bad life if you're low income, but you need help and you need access. You need good public schools around you. But yeah, but if your family's struggling with poverty, there's going to be things in your life that are really difficult. There can be a lot of stresses in your life that you may not have to deal with if you live a different kind of existence.
I bet this sounds like a poor people problem, because I always pay my rent on time and I have a job and I work very hard and I pull myself up by my bootstraps and blah, 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 blah. Nah, enough of that talk, enough of that think, because believe it or not, you are much closer to being homeless than you are to being rich.
So there's a site, and I always encourage people to look at it because it's free data. SQM is a market research, a real estate market research company. You just go in, put in the postcode 2450 for COFS, and it will tell you what's the vacancy rate, how many actual dwellings are available for rent. So in COFS last year in October, the vacancy rate was 0.1%, right? 0.1. October, so last month, it's 0.6 in COFS. In 12 months, rents have gone up 25% in cost. And in terms of when we think of how many dwellings are actually available in cost to rent, there are 38.
38 in total.
38.
That's right. 38 properties. Which means if you're a renter, you could be getting a notice to vacate your premises tomorrow. Which means you are 90 days away from being in the Thunderdome with the rest of the renters battling it out for those 38 properties. A lot of people have found themselves in that position, and a lot of them haven't secured a place and found themselves a part of what is becoming the working homeless. Dean Evers from Hope for the Homeless charity shop explains what this is.
A lot of the homeless get up every morning, wherever they may be, and I know some that live in a tent, go to the caravan park, toilets, showers, get ready, and go to work,
yeah,
and come home and live in a tent.
So there are people in offices right now, like there could be people in this building who are living like that.
Yeah, and it's the stigma, yes, it's not something you race around and tell everybody. Same thing, if you win lotto, you don't tell anybody either, for the obvious rather reason. But, and it's that stigma, like, well, what did you fail? What did you do wrong? So you got to sort of wrap your head around that too and go, well, if you do nothing wrong, and if I can't find something in 90 days, there's just that, well, wow, that could be me.
It's an incredibly tough spot to find yourself in, and once you're in it, it can be quite difficult to pull yourself out of it.
You lost your house, you lost your car, you lost your job. You're sitting on the street begging for money because you have no money, and then people don't make eye contact with you and shun you. Your self-esteem is an all-time low already, and the next thing you do is suicide because you go, I'm not living anymore, I've gone past living. And so some small gesture, give me a bottle of water or give me a sandwich, may just bring that person back from that point where they go, yeah, my life was shit today, I was going to end it, but wow, someone was kind to me. And just said a cup of coffee, what does kindness cost? Yeah, bugger all, really, in the scheme of things. Yeah, it's a tough life for them. And I think a lot of them sleep, a lot of homeless men particularly sleep during the day, because at night they're going to be watching their gear. So if they miss the soup kitchen, which runs between, I think it's like 1:30 to 2:30, they open for an hour. Great job. So if you miss that window of opportunity to get a feed, you don't eat. I can't, most of us can't imagine going out with one meal, let alone six.
Yeah, I mean, I go more than a couple of hours without eating. Yes. I get really grumpy.
<That's right. laughs> So imagine you're on that footpath, begging for a feed, and no one wants to talk to you, and you're already down with low self-esteem.
Yeah.
You've lost everything. Your wife's taken the kids because, you're now classified as a lousy father and a provider, and you're on the street there, and you've got nothing except, your coat and a duffel bag.
To pull yourself out of that, I mean, I think about the job interviews I've gone for where I've felt nervous, haven't felt like I'm up to the task. To tell somebody in that position, oh, just go and get a job, the amount of confidence it has to take for you to approach somebody and say, hey, give me a job, and all that. I couldn't imagine somebody in that position just thinking that was even the realm of possibilities.
When you applied for those jobs, you slept in a bed that night. You got up in the morning, had a shower, had a shave, you had to put a nice fresh clothes on.
Yep.
Did your hair, brush your teeth, got in your car, drove the appointment on time, all those things.
Still didn't get any of those jobs either.
And look at you now, king of the hill. and so there's that person that's going to sleep in a tent if he's lucky. No hot shower in the morning, no breakfast, nowhere to get changed. Where does he keep his clean clothes? They'll be all wrinkled up in his bag. So he goes, why am I bothering? He's going to rock up against someone who's got all those nice everyday trimmings we all become used to, and he's going to compete against them. And he could be the smartest bloke in the room, but if he's, unfortunately, looks like the worst bloke in the room, he doesn't have a chance. And, he won't have had a shower, perhaps, so he's going to, body odour and all the rest of it. So he's going to, again, his self-esteem takes another shot. How many shots can they take?
As this demographic of vulnerable people grows, it's having a massive impact on our existing social services. And it has people like Jesse from Mission Australia concerned.
Mission Australia is a national faith-based charity. We deliver housing and homelessness services, children, youth, family and community services, mental health, alcohol and other drug services, as well as disability, inclusion and support, employment skills and training, and heaps of other services all across the country. The reality of the situation is, you know, that Coffs Harbour is in a housing crisis. One of the things that we're all anxiously anticipating the release of is the 2021 census data. As of now, we're working off of the latest census data, which is 5 years old. It was from 2016. And back in 2016, it showed that Coffs Harbour has seen a 15% increase in the number of people experiencing homelessness, you know, from the previous census, and that's a higher rate than the national average. In Cowper, which takes in Coffs Harbour, we're in the 10th top electorate in Australia for rental stress.
In all of Australia?
Yeah, with 7,698 households in Cowper experiencing that rental stress. You know, on the mid-north coast, there's almost 3,000 households on the social housing wait list at a time when there's been a 73% decrease in private rental vacancies. So you could see how it's almost like the perfect storm. Well, we'll expect to see an increase in housing stress, and we won't have those numbers and those details until that census data is released. But you can get a sense of what's happening and what that data is going to look like from the increase in requests for support, from the increase in requests for people who are going to food pantries and emergency food outlets, you know, and different social services. It's probably like the social service safety net exists for times like this, but it's very stressed. There's probably never been, you know, a crisis like this. And, you know, who knows? I mean, I couldn't tell you when the last time we've had, you know, it's like a perfect storm. You know, on the mid-north coast, you know, you're looking at about 3,000 households on the social housing wait list, you know, at a time when you've seen a significant decrease in access to private rentals. So you'd imagine that, you know, 3,000, you know, social houses would be a good start.
So if we built 3,000 new houses just for social housing tomorrow,
yeah,
each one of those houses would have a family that would be ready to move in.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that wouldn't take long to tenant. That would be very swiftly tenanted.
As property prices in the area rapidly rise, many landlords are selling houses to cash in on the boom, while some others are evicting current tenants in order to lease the same house for significantly more money. It's resulted in many people being served a 90-day no-fault termination letter, meaning a search for a new home begins with little hope in sight. Nina is one of these people.
Single woman, widowed, disabled, and I'm living with my son, daughter-in-law and granddaughter. We moved in together when my husband died. We've been in two rentals in 4 years. Now we've been kicked out again. So we got the 90-day, it went up for sale, so we had the 90-day notice.
Nina explains how stressful it is competing with too many other renters over too few properties.
Really, really hard. The last house we were in, we also had a 90-day vacate notice which was sold as well. And these last two searches, I've never seen it like this before. I've never seen the amount of people going for properties before. It's quite disheartening. You've got to kind of think of how am I going to get picked? What can I do to stand out from the crowd? So, you know, you obviously put your best foot forward, you're polished up and you're looking your best. Then you look around and you see there might be 20 other groups, not 20 other people, but 20 other groups. And you're thinking, how am I going to get picked over these guys? My daughter-in-law works, my son is my carer, and yeah, and then we've got the little 9-year-old. Well, obviously I've got a pension and he's got a pension as well. So we are up against people who are, you know, you might have four people who are applying for a house who have four separate people on the one lease, who have four incomes.
And with increased competition, it's only natural that people will do whatever they can to secure a lease, including rental bidding. That is, offering more money than the set weekly rate.
I had a talk to a real estate, I won't name them or her, but they did inform me that a lot of the places are getting rented. The people applying are offering up to 12 months rent in advance, which then means, you know, somebody like myself has got no hope of matching that. The owners like it because it's like, you know, big dollar signs go off. When we moved, we were paying $440 for a four-bedroom house into this, which is four-bedroom, and was $520. So you had that jump to the same thing. You're looking at $650, $680. The pensions haven't gone up. Wages haven't gone up, as you've said. it all comes down to me, to greed. 100%, you know, people want to make money, that's fine, that's good, but there's got to be some moral code going on. Got to be some, you know, moral and greed where it stops.
Well, Ben, if she can't afford to be in the area, maybe she should look elsewhere for something cheaper. We can't always get what we want. Rolling Stones sung a song about that, so it's got to be true. And look, I get where you're coming from. But Nina isn't asking for a beachfront property or demanding the guest house at Villa Vivante. She simply wants to remain in the community she's called home for 27 years, a place where she's got a network of family and loved ones.
I've looked at granny flats in other areas, from right down to the south coast of Sydney and inland. We've looked at houses in different areas, and it's pretty much the same. One reason I won't leave the area is because I have a doctor here. I've had the same doctor for 22 years, and then when he retired, he passed the baton to his colleague, so I've had him for like 5 years, and I don't want to change doctors. I can't. I moved to Queensland years ago after I hurt my back, and I lived there for a year, but I found even up there, I was trying to find a doctor that understood what was wrong with me without having to go through all the scans again, and who knew what to prescribe and how to look after me. And I struggled with that. So when I came back to Coffs, I was like, "That's it, I'm staying now."
Nina's termination date is November 30, which means by the time this podcast is released, she will have only 1 week left to secure a new home. A deadline she doesn't feel optimistic about.
I'm terrified that I'm not. And if I'm honest, I don't think we are. So the next thing would be storage for our staff. Then I've got a couch to sleep on for December, and then January I've got to rethink what I'm going to be doing.
That deadline coming and going is a grim reality for a lot of people, including Ness, a mother of three currently living out of a motel.
I had to leave my last rental, I think I left early August. I was given, at the start of the year, I was, instead of renewing the lease, I was given a termination notice. I was meant to be out in May, but I didn't get a place. I was struggling, so I had to ask him for more time, which he gave me 3 extra months. So I was still applying for a few houses, but, you know, also it's the whole price range thing, so there wasn't a lot I could apply for either. They've sort of converted the one way in. It's called a family room. You walk in and it's like a lounge room area, but it's got like 2 bunk beds there. So that's where the kids are sleeping. And then attached to that, you've got like the kitchen and the toilet and shower. And then I've got my own separate room. Like it's attached, but you know, it's got like a door. So yeah, I guess they call it a 2-bedroom, but it's more like 1 converted to 2.
Like many renters across the Coffs Coast, Ness was already very aware of the dire situation the rental market was in. The moment she got her termination notice, the results were devastating.
As soon as I got the notice, I broke down in tears crying. You know, like, what else do you do? Like, I was devastated, you know, just not something I want to happen, especially now being a single parent. I just knew it was going to be so much harder to get a place with just me and the kids. Plus, I've got animals as well, so that's another issue. I've had to put them in temporary care at the moment. So at the moment, when I'm applying for houses now, I'm not putting the pets down because that's what it's come to. You know, I'm willing to rehome my dog permanently if I have to, as sad as it is, but that's kind of what it's come to. I've got to prioritise my kids, you know. It's not even safe being here. There's been full of junkies. Yeah, look, somebody was stabbed outside my door at like the 1 or 2 a.m. Sunday. And so yesterday the police had to come and, you know, tape it all off, and we had to sort of move away, and I just went and sat upstairs at a friend's place up there. So, yeah, so it's not safe being here at all. So, yeah, there's been a lot of junkies, and a few days before that there were about 8 cops upstairs because there was a drug dealer up there cooking, that sort of thing. Yeah, there's been a lot of families come and stay here and have to put up with that stuff. I've even had random men rock up wanting sex, you know, because there's been escorts staying here and that, you know, so they're just kind of knocking on random people's doors. It's a very unhealthy environment being here, to be honest. Like, I already sort of struggle, you know, with mental health issues. Some days I'll feel fine, and then all of a sudden I'm sort of struggling being here and not really liking it. So, and just, I guess, you know, like I said, what goes on around here, that sort of thing.
With COVID leaving many motels struggling for guests, Ness was lucky enough to work out a weekly rate as a short-term solution. But as the country begins to open up and the Coffs tourism season picks up, she's been given yet another deadline.
I've got next week to be out, and I haven't got anywhere yet. I've got till my vacate date for the motel is the 19th, but I want to sort of be out on the 18th. That way I can
get all my stuff out and tidy up the place. I rung a few caravan parks, I rung a few motels, and, you know, I guess the motels now, none of them are doing any of the weekly rate, and holiday parks, those sort of things. I'm sort of at a loss of what to do. My only option is to, on the day, ring Mission Australia, and they said they'll, like, triage me and do an assessment to sort of get me in just emergency accommodations. But I don't even know if that's guaranteed, really.
It's bloody rough. And if you've made it this far into the podcast, I feel like I should show you a picture of some cute dogs or something. It's heavy. And I promise we're about to hear from some amazing people working really hard towards solutions. But I have to play you this one last bit from Nina. Because as this crisis gets worse, people get desperate. And desperate people are easy prey to scammers who are targeting local Facebook groups, preying on people who will do anything to secure a house.
They'll send you, you know, because you are advertising far and wide who you are and what you're looking for on a lot of Facebook pages and social pages. So you put that up on a page, and then somebody came along and said, I've just sent you a private message, I've got a property that you might be interested in. That was the first one. So waited and then got all these photos and where it was and messaged with her, and she said, oh, well, just go and have a look. It's all online, and they tell you to go. She told me to go and look at the property, and it's available at this date, and she wanted to do a private rental, so she wasn't having any real estate. I thought, okay, I've done private rentals before, that's okay. And they say, oh, look, I'm overseas, or I'm out of state, or you know, whatever. Or, I mean, mine was even in hospital dying of something.
Bloody hell.
So I can't get to the property. Here's what I'll give you is my bank account details. You can put the 2 weeks' rent in it, and I'll post you the keys. And you think, okay, well, that's fair enough, until they say, okay, we'll put the bond in there as well, not give it to the bond board. That's when you read flags go off. So they ask for all the money into their bank account, and they'll post you the keys. And then the poor person who's fallen for it does all that, doesn't get the keys, obviously, goes to the house thinking what's going on and finds somebody else living in there.
And it's one of those things that, I mean, you're already desperate for a place.
Yeah.
You see somebody who just, it's like a godsend in your inbox saying, hey, I've got your ticket out of all this. It's
exactly.
A place. Because you want it so badly, you ignore all the red flags.
That's it.
And you just can't, and even then, if you hear it, like you get a hint of it, you just ignore it because you kind of, you want that place so badly. And then the bond that you had ready to go for a place that you were going to get, plus your 2 weeks rent, is just gone.
That's it. You've given it to this person. And they're like, yep, thank you.
What a disgusting thing to do.
Yet again, here we go with greed.
Yeah.
Back to greed again.
Well, there you go. People are bastards, aren't they? Luckily, not all of them are. Like Emma with the Housing Matters Action Group. She's identified that older women are one of the growing demographics at risk of homelessness. And identifying the problem is the first step to working towards a solution.
You know, we know that some of the things that tip older women into homelessness are divorce, cancer, and losing your job. Those things happen. We also know that women generally have got much lower superannuation. They've been in and out of the workforce. They're more likely to be in lower paid or casual roles. So, you know, those things work against you if you're, you know, having to compete in this really competitive rental market.
You see, it really wasn't that long ago that families lived off dad's income while mum looked after the house. Even these days, it's quite common for mum to switch to part-time after kids. This is resulting in less super, less work history, and less options employment-wise. One woman who saw this coming and gave it a big hell no was Julie Crockett, property investor and host of her own podcast, Her Investment Property, which specialises in helping women gain confidence in growing their wealth.
I found myself divorced and raising two daughters on my own. And one day I got a superannuation statement in the mail and I almost fell over because I just thought, wow, I'm going to be a very poor, at that stage I was teaching, a very poor teacher. And you know, imagine myself as this little grey-haired teacher standing in front of a whiteboard and, you know, dropping over one day because I'd never be able to afford to retire. So I thought, well, I really need to do something about that, and investigated a few different ways that I could, you know, improve my superannuation and property. And again, my parents had bought several years before that one investment property. They only ever owned one. And I thought, yeah, look, if mum and dad can do it, I can do it too. And so I launched in, did my own research. This was going back to November 2002 was the first property that I bought.
Right.
And then I got really addicted to it, and I was buying a property a year for lots of years, and then in 2010 turned it into an actual business where I haven't looked back. And yeah, there was very definitely a point in time when I had to make a decision, and the biggest reason was the fear of being in retirement and just penniless, basically. And that drove me to find a way.
Julie is not alone. As a buyer's agent, she's guided many people through their first steps in property investment. People who don't believe their super or pensions will provide for their retirement and have taken matters into their own hands.
And I think the drive for Gen Ys and millennials is to actually avoid that, like the plague. They're seeing their parents and grandparents entering these stages of their life into retirement with very little. And a lot of that drive is, boy, there's no way that I ever want to end up like that. I want to be able to have options when I retire that involve having a life. And, you know, I've worked hard all my life, and I've done everything that I've been required to do in paying tax and all the rest of it. And so, therefore, my retirement needs to be looking pretty good at the end. And I, therefore, need to be doing something now to be able to make sure that when I get to that point in my life, I've actually got some really good assets behind me that can fund my retirement.
And absolutely you should. Chase that bag. Get that bread. Stack them dollary-doos. Whatever you want to call it, being allowed to create your own fortune is something we have the right to do, like most countries in the free world. But one peculiar difference, unique to Australia, is our relationship between wealth creation and our housing. Kathy from Shelter, New South Wales, explains why.
Yeah, quite a while ago now, probably, you know, 80s and 90s, there was the whole deregulation of the financial market. And so the idea of housing as an asset, you know, something you could invest in, became quite a new thing. And since then, there's been a lot of, you know, government effort, I should say, you know, in terms of tax treatments, capital gains, concessions, negative gearing, all of these things make it really attractive for people to invest in housing, as opposed to investing in stocks or even in their own super. It does sound a bit crazy, doesn't it? I mean, there are different levels of government as well. That's probably not helpful. So you will hear Minister Stokes, who's a New South Wales planning minister, have a bit of a go occasionally in the media about, well, you federal people, you know, if only you'd scale down your negative gearing and, you know, capital gains concessions, housing maybe wouldn't be so out of control. So you do get a little bit of argy-bargy between the Commonwealth and the states. But, you know, there's so much invested now. People literally, financial investment, but also emotional investment that people have in housing, that politically, you know, it's a very tricky thing for any politician to say, we're going to pull out support to lower, you know, the value of your investment. It's we've created, an almighty rug for our backs as a country. I mean, you don't see the Commonwealth spending so much time and effort to support people to become shareholders. It's very interesting. It's a very hard thing to undo. It's a very tricky thing, though. It's a very tricky political and economic conundrum that Australians have created, which is why we say, look, if the politicians are not prepared to tackle the private housing market, which is overinflated and quite distorted, then at least stop making it worse by things like the Home Builder Program, a lot of cash grants for first home buyers sound really like a great idea, but they typically make things worse. Those things are not helpful. And we just say, could you please, government, step in and either directly or through the not-for-profit developers, go out and build houses and rent them to people for rent that are not going to cripple their whole lives. What social housing supposed to be?
Now, obviously, it's not as easy as pulling the rug from under the developers and builders and the construction industry. But at some point, we need to acknowledge that the current arrangement isn't healthy and it's not sustainable. It's a complex issue, and we'll dig deeper in later installments. One factor in the housing crisis that we can't afford to ignore any longer, however, is short-term holiday rental, the most famous being Airbnb. Airbnb revolutionised and streamlined the short-term rental market. The company itself doesn't own any assets. Instead, it connects people who own properties with people who want to rent them short-term and collecting a fee for their efforts.
It's one of the disruptors in the industry. And we'll see this more and more moving forward because technology is allowing us to do many things that were not possible before. You know, we didn't have a platform where you could scroll and look and apply online to go and stay at an Airbnb. It didn't happen. So therefore, you know, I'm excited about what's coming. I think that, you know, as an industry, we'll see many more changes in the next decade in particular. But Airbnb is one that we have and have had for a while now, obviously, that we can refer to when it comes to, yeah, disruption in the property industry. And I think that's a really good example of, you know, how people have used their creativity and their knowledge of the industry to actually create something that benefits a whole lot of people in many different ways.
It certainly is a game changer and has opened up a completely new strategy for property investing. One considered riskier, but with higher rewards.
Under normal circumstances, you might have a tenant that moves in and stays for, you know, X number of years. You know, you don't have to repaint, recarpet, do those sorts of things maintenance-wise for several years because you don't have the people movement in and out, whereas Airbnb, the opposite is the case. You've got lots of people movement. You've got, you know, that higher propensity for people for damage to occur, for things to have to be maintained at a higher level. Yeah, I would consider it basically a higher risk, higher reward scenario.
And once again, we find ourselves on this ethical seesaw. One of the great things in this country is the freedom to create our own wealth. But we also need to acknowledge that we live in a civil society with systems in place that provide a certain amount of safety. And this is the perfect time for a crash course in council zoning laws. No cheering? Okay. Here's how it works. New residential homes are built when councils release sections of land. This is done as homes are needed in the area, and therefore a portion of land is surveyed and zoned for that specific use. The same is done for industrial areas and also commercial areas. Each zoning code comes with its own restrictions, and it's what stops your next door neighbour converting their house into a steel mill, or a live music venue, or a 24-hour kebab shop. Although, that last one sounds pretty good. Zoning laws are an important function in a civilised society to ensure land is being used for an agreed purpose. And you could argue, and I am, that a house in a residential area that is operating as an Airbnb isn't operating as intended. At a certain point, our local council said, hey, we have this amount of people in our area, and therefore, we need this amount of homes. But by turning them into holiday houses, it throws off the balance. Now, I know what you're thinking. Hey, Ben, a couple of bungalows here and there on Airbnb aren't throwing off the balance too badly. Well, here's the thing. It's a lot more than a few bungalows.
As of March this year, in Cox, there were 700-plus whole house Airbnb dwelling. In the Port Macquarie Hastings area, there were 600 plus. In Kempsey, 300 plus. In Bellingen, 100 plus, you know, Sandon and Nambucca. So it's a lot of dwellings, right? It's a lot, particularly when you start to look at private rental in general. So in Coffs last year in October, the vacancy rate was 0.1%, right? 0.1. October, so last month, it's 0.6 in costs. In 12 months, rents have gone up 25% in costs. And in terms of when we think of how many dwellings are actually available in costs to rent, there are 38.
38 in total.
38. So let's compare 700 Airbnb in the costs area. So that was in March, okay? Maybe it's changed a bit. But for rent, 38. So look, we're not anti people renting their place, and you know, and if you think back to the origins of Airbnb and other, you know, the sharing economy, that's where it came from, right? And we like the idea that if you're in a holiday area and you want to rent out, you know, it was always intended, you know, like the spare room, you know, the granny flat down the back, you know, good for you. But we are concerned that it has sucked up a lot of.
Okay, just so you know, she said sucked with an S, not an F. I listened to that like 100 times. She didn't swear, okay? I just wanted to clarify.
Sucked up a lot of properties that otherwise would have been available in the general rental market. So, it's a big issue. So the state government has been tussling with it for probably the last 12 to 18 months, and it's obviously trying to juggle people's, you know, rights and desires to make a buck off their house if they want to, getting as much as they can, good for them. But the problem of some communities have been nearly gutted of just houses for ordinary people to live in.
Now, before we start ransacking every Airbnb property, tearing the striking yet inoffensive art off the wall and throwing it around the room to a soundtrack provided by a previous guest's Spotify account, some New South Wales councils have found a certain level of compromise, even if it is early days.
There's been some councils who've opted in for the restrictions, I guess, around entire houses only being able to be let for 180 days a year, which I think will have a really interesting impact. Unfortunately, councils were asked to opt into this before the legislation was developed, so only a small number of councils have opted in. And at the moment, councils can see what is in the legislation, there's no way for them to opt in now. So I think it's a bit of a wait and see, unfortunately, before we'll be able to ask our councils locally to opt into it. But it will be an interesting space that'll change, I think, if that legislation is effective. I think councils are well placed to understand the community, understand what the community needs, and to have some say around where and how much this short-term holiday letting exists.
It's important to point out that as of the release of this podcast, we're 2 weeks away from electing a new Coffs Harbour Council. I encourage you to question any potential candidates over their stance on this legislation, if, of course, it's important to you. Now, there's a few other great things being worked on to make life more bearable for renters. We'll dig deeper on these in later podcast installments, but I'll provide a nice introduction to them before we finish up. The first involves more robust protections for renters.
So one of our fellow kind of organisations, the Tenants Union, they made a submission to the Regional Housing Task Force and said what they had seen a lot more of in regional areas was an increase in what's called no ground eviction. So you could be a tenant who might become a bit of a pest in the minds of the landlord, asking for that leaking tap to get fixed. It never gets fixed. Now, at some stage, the landlord could just terminate your tenancy. It might be because they think you're a bit of a nuisance, but they don't need to tell you, okay? Because no grounds evictions is a strong landlord right in this stage. Doesn't have to be, but it is. So I don't think Australians have got their heads around the fact that lots of people rent, lots of families rent, and increasingly people will rent for their whole lives. So this notion that I think we have of we're all just on the way to becoming homeowners, well, we're not actually. And a lot of people will enter retirement as renters. And, you know, there is discrimination in the rental market about all sorts of things. So I think there's a general acceptance in other countries that renting is a legitimate form of housing, so people can't be kicked out as easily. And the length of leases, you know, we would like to see a lot more encouragement of, you know, long-term leases. So if you're a family, you don't want this thing hanging over you of every 6 to 12 months, you may or may not get your lease extended. So we think longer leases and just generally, you know, more rights to stay put. There's also some practice around rent bidding that's not great, that we're seeing a lot of around the state as people are competing for rent. There's a big campaign called Make Renting Fair that we support for the tenancy and lots of organisations do. So we encourage any renter, you know, like, you're not alone. Like, if you think it feels a bit unfair, it is.
We'll move on from that, because if any landlords are listening, I know that last line just caused your blood pressure to spike, and I don't just breathe, okay? It's going to be okay. Another core component to reducing homelessness is social housing. We heard previously in this podcast about a huge demand locally for social housing, but just how many are being built?
It's always very hard to know, Ben, because the data is very hard to get from government. So, So you can go around looking at media releases, and then you have to tease out, wait on, it's been announced before, or wait on, they're already building that. That's interesting. So these researchers went through and removed the double counting, and what they looked at in June, they looked back and they said from 2016, what we can determine is that the state government committed to building, I think it was 9,600 extra dwellings.
Hear that, Ben? Almost 10,000. It's got to be pretty good. Not really.
Our forecast, as is many other economists and advocates like our organisation, say New South Wales needs an additional 5,000 social housing dwellings every year for a decade, and that's just to catch up. So
a casual 41,000 shy of what
experts
are saying we need.
Yeah, yeah. So we're kind of way behind what we need today.
That is a lot of trips to Bunnings. It's also a lot for the taxpayer to fund, and it certainly doesn't sit well with some people. But luckily, there's a huge project underway that would integrate big business to assist in building homes through financial incentives. Jesse from Mission Australia is incredibly excited about it.
We're one of the founding partners of a collaborative project called the Constellation Project, where we're working alongside PricewaterhouseCoopers, the Red Cross, and the Center for Social Impact. And what we're trying to come up with is a solution to the question that you just asked, Ben, you know, about how do we create incentives and supports and ideas to help end homelessness within a generation. So this Constellation project commenced in early 2019, and the focus of the project is on increasing the supply of housing that's affordable for people on low to moderate incomes. And what we've been doing is combining the collective intelligence and resources and network and powers to kind of come up with a way to generate practical solutions that'll create more homes and better journeys for people at risk of or experiencing homelessness. So some of the things that people have been thinking about in respect to the scale of the investment needed has been to work more closely with NIFIC, which is the National Housing Finance and Investment Corporation, because they've been making some quite significant useful contributions in providing concessional funding to community housing providers. But there's been this idea that's been kicked around a social capital aggregator that would enable large scale private investment, like super funds, and into affordable housing. So that would demonstrate how private institutional investment can be pooled into construction capital for affordable housing. That's the kind of thing that can unlock future recurrent government co-investment. So when we think about, the scale of the problem and the recommendation of, 5,000 new homes across the next 10 years, we do respect the fact that that's a big call and that it's not, government sole responsibility, to go down the path. We just think that there is a real opportunity, for, the government and federal government to play that role in coordinating that national plan to end homelessness.